we were discussing last time yes. You said that there was nobody in England dealing with history of political theory or political thought. There was nobody to talk to.
No, I didn't say that. Plenty of people dealt with political theory.
Yes.
And plenty of people talk about political thought.
Yes.
But nobody was interested in the history of ideas.
History of ideas.
Yes. There is a difference.
Now, why is it?
Well, that's a general question, which nobody's answered.
Mm-hmm.
That is because, broadly speaking, but it's one of those answers which is not an answer, which repeats a question, which is that the English in general, like others, certain other nations, are not interested in ideas. They don't regard ideas as an object of serious study, either by academics or by journalists or by anybody else, by historians or anybody else, even by amateur historians. There are people who take an interest, but not many. Let me explain what I mean. I've said this, I think, in print somewhere. Supposing you were an educated Peruvian or an educated Indian in the 19th century, towards the second half, there were certain writers whom you either had to have read or had to have pretended to have read. They were. Know something about, at least. Bentham, maybe. John Stuart Mill, certainly. Carlyle, certainly. Spencer, certainly, in those days.
Yeah.
Darwin, certainly. Some people, Ruskin. Tolstoy read Ruskin, Tolstoy read Matthew Arnold.
Matthew Arnold.
Yes. I don't know if you're a Frenchman, whether you would have had to read Matthew Arnold. But anyhow, there were these principal thinkers of world renown. And they were regarded as the absolute the thinkers of the 19th century on social, political, and to some extent, religious, aesthetic problems. Every other country has books on the history of ideas of their own country, particularly social ideas. In Germans have a subject called Geistesgeschichte, which is a very prominent academic subject. Americans have a thing called intellectual history, which there are plenty of jobs, mainly American, but even so, all right, at least two famous books on American intellectual history. The French have plenty of books saying the Montaigne, Montesquieu, de Montesquieu à Rousseau, de Rousseau à Michelet, and de Michelet à Bergson, anything you like. Plenty of such books. The English are the only people who have no history of English ideas at all. I mean, I think there is Rabban, who is said to be too obscure to remember. Monographs, yes, but given thinkers. But no such thing as a continuous history of ideas. I don't say it's a good thing to write a book about. I think perhaps it's not the ideal thing is not to regard it as a succession, where one person influences another, and the third, and so on. All this business with influences is very dubious. But still, it's a symptom of the fact that there isn't enough interest among publishers or among writers in it as a topic. And that is so, and has always been so.
Yes.
History of movements, history of socialism maybe, history of the Oxford movement in religion, history of utilitarianism by Leslie Stephen and others. But broadly speaking, the history of English ideas, I mean, social ideas, say in the 19th century, done. Not little articles, monographs.
You mentioned the names of, let's say, 19th century. You can go back to Milton, or even further back to Hobbes. I mean, you have...
No, pre-historical ideas it is.
There is.
Yes, but not general ideas.
And when you started, I mean, occupying yourself with it, you say you had nobody to talk to.
And still haven't.
And still haven't.
No. There are people. There is somebody who has a position in Heston University. There's a man who has a position in Sussex. There's a man somewhere in East Anglia. But these are isolated persons, not in touch with each other or with me much. So there's a very intelligent man, for example, in Sussex University, who has written a history of English ideas in the mid-19th century, Victorian ideas. He's interested in it, yes. He's an exception. I can't talk to individuals. Of course I can talk to somebody like Bernard Williams or somebody like Stuart Hampshire, I mean, because educated people have a civilized guy. But professionally, people who read these people, who can tell me whether I'm right or wrong in a particular estimate. No, my interest in history writers doesn't come from reading English writers. G.M. Young is a man who wrote about 19th century English writers, but it's very, very, it's not exactly superficial, but not really that it was a genuine article.
I mean, but did you try to persuade your friends that it was an important thing?
No.
You didn't?
No. No, they all had perfect...
But it's quite incredible. I mean, friends of yours, colleagues of yours, were probably rather puzzled that you decided to make this sweet.
No. Nobody was puzzled or not puzzled. Nobody showed the least surprise. However you may explain it. Not the least. Nobody regretted it. Nobody tried to persuade me to stay with philosophy. Nobody tried to persuade me to leave it. No, there's no so to speak, people don't, in English academic life, there isn't that kind of interest in each other, and it doesn't exist.
Including close friends, I mean...
No. No, I didn't have many close friends in my life in general. Close friends, rather. In England, not very frequent. Not all that frequent.
I think that
one or two, perhaps.
I don't think that, generally speaking, people have close friends. I don't think that in this respect in England it's worse than in other places.
No, it's not worse.
I think that in my opinion, it's even better than in other places. People in England can be rather reserved and cold and have close friends. And in places like France and other places, they can be outgoing, but it doesn't mean that they have close friends.
No, but you're talking about close friends of an intelligentsia kind.
Yes.
Well, that doesn't occur in England so much, because there is no intelligentsia. Intelligentsias only exist in countries where there is a common enemy, whom these people feel they are, to some extent, embattled against in the name of progress or freedom or whatever this cause may be, which is near to our hearts. People who are against slavery make friends with each other, other people who are against slavery, as it were. In other countries, there is a church and a state which are hostile to liberal principles or liberal practices. So in France, you had an intelligentsia in the 19th century and in the 18th century. In the 18th century, and the philosophers were a kind of intelligentsia. In the 19th century, because there was still an enemy, some were pro-revolution, some were violently anti. So there was a right and a left, which battled with each other in the field of ideas. The same thing is true of Spain. The intelligentsia, because there is a black, the oppressive church. Russia, of course, invented the word. The word is invented there. There's not much of intelligentsia in Scandinavia. There are civilized people and intelligent people, but intelligentsia as such, nothing like as prominent as these other places. In Vienna there was intelligentsia, because it was the Roman Catholic Church. In Italy there was intelligentsia, Some of them became communists in the end, because there was a church. That's what they're opposed to.
Is it only in Vienna? Is it only the church, or is it the special situation of, let's say, being a capital of an empire with so many nationalities, having to cope with so many?
Well, that's what created the general atmosphere in Vienna of, say, anti-Semitism, of course. But that's a different question. I'm only answering about intelligentsia.
Yes, and
the fact that there are many nationalities in Vienna is not a cause of the creation of intelligentsia, just clash of nations, clash of people who belong to different cultures. That doesn't create intelligentsias. That just creates conflict. That just creates nationalism, anti-nationalism, Catholicism, anti-Catholic, but not solidarity among people engaged, as they feel, in some struggle against some oppressive force which is in power. The church, nobody talks about in England about being in the hands of the clergyman. Hands of priests, yes. Who speaks? Nobody says he's in the hands of the clergyman. Means nothing. Church of England is not such an institution. In fact, some members of the Church of England today complain that it isn't oppressive, it isn't organized, and it isn't conservative, and it isn't militant enough.
And mind you, from their own point of view, they may have a point, I think, now.
Oh, maybe, yes.
Fundamentalists within the Church.
Yes, well.
Because I think that the liberals are going too far. From the church, as an institute.
Could be.
I mean, we may be facing now a very interesting phase in the history of
I
the
cannot take an interest in the Church of England.
I realize that you don't take interest, generally speaking. I think
they have a very decent social record. So have the non-reformist churches. In England, the church was never, in the 18th century perhaps, it was allied to the squires in the countryside and was, broadly speaking, anti-Whig and anti-progressive, it was. But how much force it had is not clear. I have a colleague in All Souls called Jonathan Clark who thinks that Locke and Hume and Priestley and all these people, anyhow, this from what might be called the progressive wing of English thought, had no influence whatever. The only thing which really had influence was squire and parson. And the situation was not that different from 17th century France. England was a good ancien régime country. I think this is exaggerated. I don't think that's true. Books were not burnt by the University of London as they were by the Sorbonne. I think it's slightly absurd. But that there is such a view. There is a view that England was a good, solid, conservative country, and all these liberal thinkers were not read by anybody and had no influence on anybody. What people read were sermons and not pamphlets by a lot of intellectuals. Could be. I'm not an 18th century historian. He's not an English historian in the 18th century. Germany was a bit different. There you took it. Beginnings of some kind of intelligentsia, not so much against the church as against the monarchy. Against Frederick the Great, who himself was a highly enlightened figure. Frederick the Great and his successors against Prussia and the rigid discipline which it imposed on its citizens. Both ways. The right-wing and the left-wing intelligentsia both exist in 19th century Germany.
Yes, but coming back to our starting question, I mean,
what caused me to take an interest in it is, of course, first of all, having to write on Karl Marx, which made me read 18th century anticipators of Marx, which is French history of ideas in the 18th century. That's what got it going. Then Herzen and the Russians, and Marx and the Russian Revolution, all that coalesces. So that the combination of 18th century radicalism and 19th century, there is a very good article about me, though I have to say it, in the Corriere della Sera, 3 days ago, by a very intelligent Italian left-wing critic, my great respect, called Strada, who has written an article in connection with his prize, as I was so fortunate as to have got. He says that one of my interests in Russia, my interest in history of ideas, partly derives, and I think he's right, and I never quite thought of that that way before, from the fact that European ideas, and that he doesn't say that, but it's true, there isn't a single idea in social or political or even aesthetic or general realm of ideas in Russia, doesn't come from the West. In theology, maybe there are, but about that I know very little. I think Dostoevsky's ideas come from the West, but they come from deep-rooted, so to speak, Russian Orthodox Church, of course, mainly, and that kind of thing. But if you take what might be called the history of political and social ideas in Russia, in general, it comes to the West. But it never got, for whatever reason, to such an acute and exaggerated form as it reached in Russia. And so the collision of these ideas is much more violent and much more studied, much more easier to follow in Russia than it is in the West. I think I have said that in one form or another. What I've said in my writings is that if we take Paris in the 1840s, there are plenty of doctrines there. They are no doubt completely different, but they clash, but not very violently. On the whole, the general intellectual climate, which all these ideas nullify each other to some extent, or at least weaken each other. In Russia, you have a vacuum. When the ideas come, they dominate minds. They're accentuated. Because people really believe them, in an almost naive way, they become transformed and become weapons, which they are not so much in the West. There is a story which I think I tell about, you see, for example, Herzen tells you that all kinds of third-rate French thinkers traveled in false bottoms in Russian suitcases to Russia, and the Russians became terribly enthusiastic about them. Fourth and fifth-rate French thinkers were tremendously admired. In fact, there's a story, which is not the point, about a French mathematician who discovered that his theories, which were not at all well received in France, were lectured about in Russia. He burst into tears. This could well have happened to the minor disciples of Saint-Simon.
Yeah. Can you compare any other civilization or place or period to this situation of Russia vis-a-vis? I mean, is it on the margins of Europe in general? I mean, was it in Spain the same, or in Italy, or in the North? No.
What, so violent? I knew nothing about Spain.
Or the Balkans? I mean, the impact of Western thought was so strong, so deep.
Oh, well.
That it played so central a role in the life of the intelligentsia. I think that in the Balkan, yes.
You mean European ideas or yes. English ideas in particular? European ideas. Well, Latin America, enormously. United States, to a very large extent,
that's the major example.
India, certainly. Japan, certainly. Lately, I mean, the last 30, 40, 50 years. Oh, I think everywhere outside Europe. I mean, here and there in Africa. I mean, of course, I mean, if you take the Middle East, there isn't a great deal of discussion of ideas, not really in the original, but there isn't much discussion. Since so far as there is any ideology, certainly not native, apart from Islam. Apart from Islam, that's what Islam is against.
The Middle East is a very good example.
What Islam is against is the unfortunate penetration of Western ideas. Nationalism, socialism, communism, secularism.
Yeah. But we came to this point of the intelligentsia just indirectly.
Take for example, Algiers is a very good example. There are quite a lot of Arab intellectuals in Algiers, quite civilized ones. It's entire Council of France. Potters are born in Algerian soil.
Well, that surely you are right. I mean, in the ex-French Empire, it's even stronger than the ex-British Empire.
That's certainly.
Because the campaigns to educate the elite.
And because the French paid more attention to ideas.
To ideas. And education.
Yes, certainly.
I mean, creating a elite was a major facet of...
Creating a Francophile elite. Exactly.
And it's still very much so.
Exactly.
No doubt about it.
If the Germans had entered colonies for any length of time, they would also have tried. But they weren't in a position to. They would have tried.
They might have tried, but the French is a deep-rooted tradition. I believe that it goes back certainly to the Jesuits, and maybe even further back, the idea of imperialism by assimilation.
Certainly. The French wanted to create a France outside Outre-mer, whereas the English wanted to leave natives alone.
Exactly. And I suspect the Germans might be the same as the English. I don't know.
I wonder. Maybe.
But it's very interesting, you see, even from our own point of view.
The Italians should have been like the French, but I don't think much happened in...
But the tribes, you know, the Italian government financed teachers of Italian.
That they did. In Palestine, even in high school.
I mean, in this respect, they imitated the French.
But if you ask what are Italian ideas,
it's a little thin. So they thought in terms of language and.
But Bourguiba's Tunis, it can't be said to have been penetrated by French idea. Well, perhaps they were. Tunisian intellectuals, yes. But Libya? Yeah. Not much.
Well, but in Libya you didn't have a local elite anyway. Tunisia was far more advanced than Libya, even...
But Tunis was French, and Libya was Italian. Yeah. So in Libya you don't get it.
No,
nor among the Somalis.
Yeah. Nor in Ethiopia.
Well, Ethiopia... Not long enough.
It's very interesting. It touches upon even Jewish history and Zionist history. The French government supported and encouraged that. Are you called?
No.
Surely?
Right.
Because we...
No, it's all right, yes.
I mean, the Alliance Française, as educational network.
Oh, I know.
Was supported by the government.
Certainly.
It's true that in Germany you had the same nucleus, the Hilfsverein, that was supported by the government, and they tried to help, let's say, the Jewish community in Palestine also in education, in the education system, but it never got the
No, but I mean.
But in England, they never tried even.
Sarona and Wilhelma were not centers of German culture.
Yeah.
You can't say that. But what you can say is that Herder, for example, is a figure.
Had
an enormous influence in the Balkans. In the Balkans. And not in the Balkans, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Czechoslovakia. Czech nationalism owes everything to Herder. So does probably, for all I know, probably various, and certainly Jewish nationalism does. They may not know it. Zionism was given impulsion by that kind of cultural nationalism. Talmon used to be quite good on that. Rather good on that subject. On the influence of Herder and his particular kind of cultural nationalism on backward communities.
Yes, but that's entirely different story. That's history of ideas.
Yes.
And when we were speaking about education as a tool of imperialism...
No, that's a different story. That's a different story, of course. Of course. Still, the Germans Germanized those first Hungarian empire. They did. I mean, if you think, again, Talmud tells the story of two Czech schoolmasters in the 1790s, saying, or some sort of date, saying the Czech language will soon cease to be spoken. Everything is gone. Nothing is left. They, little did they know what would happen. But the German influence in German, the Austro-Hungarian Empire is German-speaking.
But it's not Germany.
The German Austro-Hungarian Empire is German-speaking. Hungarians spoke German, Czechs spoke German, certainly. They all did. And they read German books. And they had German universities. And they produced German intellectuals.
But it might have been a natural process and not a deliberate policy.
Well, deliberate policy in the sense that the government is in Vienna. And if the officials are German and only speak German, there is no other. And schools are created. German schools, which are obviously superior to the native schools, and they are subsidized, and others are not. Comes the same. I mean, Kafka's father spoke Czech, but Kafka is a German writer. It didn't occur to him to write his books in Czech.
The phenomenon is clear.
I don't know how much Polish Martin Buber spoke.
No, he didn't.
No, is he?
Yeah. No, but again, it doesn't yet mean that it was such a deliberate policy like the French. I think it may be partly...
No, I agree. The French...
The phenomenon is there.
And don't let's discuss it too long.
Yeah.
The French think French civilization is the only civilization there is. And that French culture is culture. And therefore, if you want to educate people, there is nothing but French education which is any good. They really believe that.
Yeah.
And nobody else believes that about themselves.
Okay.
It's a form of tremendous cultural chauvinism, which is unparalleled anywhere else.
And the belief that you can... Yeah. I mean, the Germans are also culturally chauvinist, but I think they prefer you can be a cultural chauvinist and not...
But not wish to impart it to others.
Exactly.
No, the French were at once universalist and chauvinist.
Exactly.
The Germans did. Germans didn't mind what foreigners did.
But coming back to... I mean, we came to the intelligentsia just indirectly. We are speaking about friends among the intelligentsia, friendship. And I think that you attach too much importance to the correlation between having close friends among the intelligentsia and the very existence of the phenomenon of intelligentsia. You see what I mean?
Mm,
I mean, you can have intellectual friends in England.
Intellectuals are not intelligentsia. Intellectuals don't necessarily make close friends. Intelligentsia does. Because they're a band of brothers. And they're fighting against a common cause. And therefore, morally and spiritually, there is an affinity. Among intellectuals, there doesn't have to be.
Yes, that I can see. But they've always... As a social phenomenon, it's clear. But that's when you speak about friendship. When we come to close friendship...
Yes.
Close friendship...
that's a different matter. Nobody can tell.
Exactly.
It's purely individual. It's an individual affair.
Exactly.
No general propositions.
Exactly.
I hold, of course
exactly.
not. Of course.
But, I mean, that... You, I mean, so in this respect, we understand each other. All right. Now, who were your closest friends?
In when? At what stage of my life?
You said that you had very few close friends.
No. I had more close friends before marriage than after, which is a natural effect of marriage.
You really think so?
Absolutely. It's true of me. and to every married person I know.
Yes. Yeah, I mean,
if they're happily married, if marriage is success, a certain number of friends are automatically shed, partly because one's wife's taste may not be the same one's own, but partly because one needs friends less. If one is married, one relies less upon city one's loneliness is cured. One of the great causes of friendship is, of course, solitude, the need to talk to people, to be with people, to have contact with human beings. Oh, certainly it's true. No, I had quite a lot of close friends before the war, certainly. Mainly in Oxford, which is where I lived. Who were they? Well, as an undergraduate, I had a friend called Bernard Spencer, a poet. I had a friend called Ernest Coppleston, who afterwards became a high civil servant, who looked after academic affairs of the Treasury. I had a friend at school, even. I had a friend called Arthur Calder Marshall, still alive, who I haven't seen for 40 years. I had a friend called Aviram Halpern, the son of Georg Halpern, yes. A close friend, certainly. I had Walter Ettinghausen at school, was certainly a close friend, not so much afterwards, but certainly in those days. And you see, then in Oxford, I made quite a lot of friends in my college, who were my close friends as an undergraduate. And to jog my memory. Bernard Spencer, I told you. Coppleston, I told you. Humphrey House was a very eminent English scholar. Became a great friend. The notorious Gorondo Rees is now talked about because of his wild attacks on various people as being spies and so on. Became a close friend, certainly.
He was your generation.
My generation, exactly. He certainly became a close friend. So did Freddie Eyre, philosopher, became a close friend, certainly.
And did you keep the friendship with Freddie Eyre for many years?
Oh, yes, it continues. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not quite so close as it was in those days, but it goes on. I occur a little too frequently in the first volume of his autobiography. He constantly competes with me and squares up to me and so on, tries to defend himself against potential attacks on my part and tries to make out that in some respects he's superior to me, all of which may be true. But still, I'm a figure in his life, and he in mine. And Stuart Hampshire, of course, in the middle 30s, and Philip Toynbee, was a friend, not a close friend, but certainly a friend, and so was Jeremy Hutchinson, who is now Lord Hutchinson, who is a friend, Ben Nicholson, they all lived together in a house he before. Let me see, in other words, ladies, Mary Fisher, daughter of the Warden of New College, who is only recently retired as principal of St. Hilda's College, was a close friend. So, I'm sorry? It's called Mrs. Bennett.
Yes. She lived in Surrey, I believe.
Yes.
Yes.
Where did you meet her?
Well, she was a close friend of Elizabeth Monroe.
I didn't know that.
Yes. And once Elizabeth Monroe took me, 25 years ago.
Colonial office, she wasn't a colonial office, you see. Mary Fisher worked in the colonial office during the war. She's a Roman historian by profession.
Yes.
But she worked in the colonial office and married a colonial office official called Bennett.
Ah, there was a Bennett.
I never
didn't
know which. Well, that would be it.
Oh, that problem.
Well, I wonder if it's the same. Someone told me it wasn't. But it may have been.
I'll check.
So they're still married to each other.
I see.
I think probably it's the same. Okay. I think that's the man you did have problems with.
No, and I'll check exactly what the...
Could well be. John Bennett.
I think that the man...
John.
In the talking, he was giving his Palestine daily.
John Bennett.
John. I'll check it.
And also Cyprus. She dealt with Cyprus, I think.
Well.
Near enough. Exactly. Do. Because
yeah.
I've always suspected him of being an enemy.
Yeah. I see how far he was an enemy. I don't remember.
No, if the same one, he was an enemy.
Well.
She never brought it up to me. We never talked about Israel in after years. They still live in Oxford.
Yeah.
The Bennets. But I thought I drifted apart from her after marriage. She said to me, I hear you are married to a divorcee. Okay, slightly weakened relations between us. Rather old-fashioned. She was a great friend, very intimate. And so were the two daughters of an essayist called Robert Lind. There was an essayist, used to write for New Statesman, under the title YY, in the 30s. Charming essays they were. Not very important kind. He had two daughters called Sheila Lind and Moira Lind. With Sheila Lind I was in love. With Moira Lind was a communist. So was Sheila Lind. They both became fervent communists. But Sheila left over Hungary. And Moira, my friend, still is. And her husband is called Gaster, son of the Haram. He was the solicitor of the Communist Party all his life.
Yes.
And still is retired now. He's very old. Certainly Antrim Road. How do you know?
A friend of mine lived there. I mean, Israeli scholar.
Correct.
One Antrim Road.
Certainly. He lived with one, yes. Could be. He still lives there and his wife.
Fantastic.
She's a very nice, she's a charming woman. She's sweet, and sweet, innocent, high-minded Irish girl. Of the most very beautiful she was. And a very pure character. And once she became a communist, remained one. And she recently said to me, about 3 or 4 years ago, now there are no good countries left. It was a very sad remark. I think it was after Czechoslovakia. Something like that. Let me see who else, my friends. Christopher Hill was never a great friend of mine. In the old, early old self days, but a friend. Let me see now. Who else? The early old self, when I'm talking about, yes, well, there must have been others whom I don't remember. Von Trott was a great friend. Adam von Trott was a great friend. Really was a friend. In a quite genuine way. David Astor, never.
Now, for all those names, I mean, a continuous...
Sheila Granduff, to whom Adam von Trott proposed, who wrote a book on Czechoslovakia, and then has now written an autobiography, who was married to various people.
I know her. I came across her.
Great friend.
I think she is.
Still is.
Can you
see? I don't know.
Yes. I just met her 2 months ago.
Yeah. Here in Oxford.
She's not in a college, but she used to be...
Curtis girl, I knew.
And I was told that she was a daughter of
She's called Mrs. Wait, I'll tell you of first husband's name. He was not a man I liked much, but he's dead. What was his name? There she is, her father's name. I know her, the daughter.
Remember.
She was a great friend. And she lives in Ireland, married to a Russian called Sokolov. These are all people. Herbert Hart was a great friend. Exactly then. Yes. And remained one. And his wife was called Miss Fisher Williams. Great friend independently of him.
You were friends independently?
Certainly.
Because so many people like Herbert and don't like Jenny.
No, I'm very fond of both.
I'm fond of both.
I'm devoted to both. I knew I was an undergraduate.
Yeah.
from those days.
So, I mean, long existing friendship since those days, it's Herbert and Stuart.
There was a lady called Miss Walker, who is the aunt of Edward Mortimer, his mother's sister, with whom I had a complicated relation. She was a pupil of mine, and in some rather insane way fell in love with me. And I was very moved by all this, but it came to nothing, and she went mad and is alive, and has the last 50 years been in the lunatic asylum. She's Edward's actual aunt. It's not a very balanced family.
Did you any time face the possibility or problem of marrying Zoya?
Oh yes, I didn't face it because it didn't actually occur, but I certainly could have done.
You could have done.
Yes.
And you wouldn't mind?
No. No, I couldn't. Would have minded. Yes, they would have minded. I don't know how strongly. They wouldn't have forbidden it or made it ever. They wouldn't have said, they wouldn't speak to me again. They wouldn't. There wouldn't be a boarding crisis. They would have been saddened. Saddened. No. If I really wanted to marry somebody, I would. I never came near it.
And now, did you correspond continuously with any friend?
There's no brief excel. There's no correspondence from beginning to end.
Why?
Because I don't write letters in that sense. I reply to letters sent to me. I don't suddenly sit down and write a kind of letter to an old friend saying, this is what's happening to me and how are you?
Even when you were young?
Even when I was young. Well, I don't know. I can't remember. I tell you, was a great friend in my Oxford days. That was Elizabeth Bowen, the writer. She was a tremendous friend and remained one.
That's what interested me. Those who remained friends.
And remained to our dying day. She became more of a friend to my wife in the end, but still she remained a friend. I'm trying to think who else is a friend. David Cecil became a great friend, but that was only later. That was after 38.
After 38?
38, yes.
And how long, I mean...
We both became fellows of New College in 38.
And then in the war years, where was he?
In England.
And after 45?
I came back to England anyway. Absolutely. My best friend in New College. My best friend in Oxford, in fact. Hampshire was not in Oxford then. James Joel was a friend. Pupil was a pupil. Pupil and friend.
You had a soft spot for James, I don't know.
He was a pupil, I liked him very much. He became a friend.
I know that you like him.
He became a friend, certainly. Very positively so. He would have, I think he'd confess that. Not so much lately. I don't see him very much now.
But you were trying, I would say even consistently, to claim that...
Paul Sparrow was a friend of the Warden of All Souls, who's now gone off his head. He was certainly a friend. Douglas Dre was a friend. Anti-Israeli, as he always has been, and xenophobic to a violent degree. Certainly he was a friend.
No,
in All Souls. All Souls. 1932 onwards. Certainly a friend.
Now, you tried several times to belittle your position, let's say academically. I mean, you when you were an undergraduate and then when you were young.
Yes.
Now, why do you do it? I mean, it's not the point. I mean, after all, when you see memoirs of so many people who were your either pupils or colleagues and so on, some often they mention you as something exceptional.
Really, because
so why do you believe?
Because there is, I made some impact on them personally, but not intellectually. I never had disciples till very lately, one or two perhaps. I never had real disciples, never, There's no school of followers of Berlin.
Oh, right.
There's no, no, never. Let's other people
say,
did.
I may even can see why. I mean, because of you don't want to be an imposing.
No, I hate being an influence.
I can see.
Partly, I didn't want to influence people. I've always been terrified of altering people's lives.
I wouldn't believe how I could understand it before you said it, because
it's
I
true.
Have the empathy.
It's true. It's true.
That I can see.
It's true.
That you, I mean, and
I would be troubled. If anyone did something because it was under my influence, I would have been deeply troubled. Because I never believed in the validity of what I believe to sufficient extent to preach it.
Here there is a real, it's very interesting because your psychological tendency and your intellectual creed are in affinity. I mean, you are against Hegel. That's very, I mean, we don't...
Let me explain. Whenever I expound ideas or opinions, I always overdo it. I expound them with considerable passion. I expound them almost dogmatically. I've always been accused of that. I go too far, and I become too obstinate, and I don't see, and I try and reject objections to it with a great stubbornness, and I throw myself into whatever I'm saying. But within this, there's profound skepticism about their validity. It's a very curious combination. And I defend them with passion, partly because I'm not absolutely secure in holding them. If I were, I would do it in a much more tranquil and balanced way.
Well, maybe.
That's the same way which I defend certain of my heroes when I speak with passion about ideas. All these characters whom I describe, I slightly import myself into them. They're made a little bit to resemble me, to too high a degree, because I enter into them a little too strongly, and in fact they enter into me. But if you ask me whether I am prepared absolutely to put my hand in my heart and defend these ideas against all objections, never quite. There is deep skepticism together with a certain desire to believe.
I'm very happy we came to it, unfortunately at the end, but we'll have to discuss it, because here we come to a point which is very essential. I believe that really you came to your, let's say, intellectual belief, and it came to you naturally, to your nature, to the character, and it was because it's really fantastic how I mean the very fact that you are against any monopoly of theory, against any hegemony of theory, suits perfectly this natural inclination.
Yes, certainly. No, I'm sure that's right. I'm sure that's right. It's a matter of temperament.
Yes, it's a matter. Yes. You came to your
inevitably, my political views or my moral views are certainly shaped by my temperament, and not by reading books.
And that's why you are so influential, despite the fact that you don't want to create a school, and you never wanted to
dominate people. I never want to dominate.
I can see.
I loathe responsibility.
I can see.
That's the point. I loathe responsibility. In an almost cowardly way. I loathe it. I don't want to be committed in that sense. I mean, to people's lives. I don't want to be responsible for, so to speak, what other people are and do. The only movement to which I suppose I was wholeheartedly committed all my life is Zionism. And the paradox is that in the 30s and even early 40s, I didn't know very many Jews. I lived an un-Jewish life. The number of Jewish friends I had in the 30s was injured, so to speak, in contrast with non-Jews, very small indeed. All this happened after the war.
And I mean, this is also very, I must say, it's really incredible, this consistent attachment to Zionism, and I mean, and Judaism, and